This is the Freedom Fiends. Been a while, huh? Yeah, I've missed y'all. It's cool. It's cool yakking on the air. Airing my dirty stinkables on the air. And furthermore, here's part 1074 in my list of how the world has harmed me. Nah, I'm not a social justice warrior, so I don't do that. I did have an interesting, I don't know if I'd call it redemption in the third act, but this is something that like lesser people would have sued over, but I just realized this is the price of doing business on the human planet sometimes. It's things like this. So there's I talked recently on here about how my wife was dropping off a check at the bank at the drive up and using the drive up normally as you do, you know, pulled up next to it and her front left tire was punctured by something and she got out and it was basically like rebar or actually long screws, industrial screws in cement, you know, 8 inches long, sticking out of some newly poured cement, hardening cement that, you know, had been like sheared off or cut off on the end with a diamond saw probably and was just like a knife. I mean, this is crazy. That a place where people drive up and walk up, it says you can walk up, it's a walk up, drive up, ATM has basically, you know, four knife edges sticking out of the building, 8 inches at ground level. And she, you know, ended up, had to wait for AAA and then called the bank, or I emailed the bank and let them know. And I didn't say anything like, hey, give us money. I basically wanted to see if they would offer, and if they didn't, I was just going to go talk about it on the radio. You know, so they called back. They called my wife's cell phone, called me first, I guess, and then called her. And it was the president of the bank. That's what happens in a small rural town in Wyoming, is the president of the bank calls you. And I'm not going to say he intimidated her, but he didn't apologize. He didn't. Basically, what we wanted was an apology and a what we were looking for was an apology and a, yeah, we'll fix that. You know, we paid $120 for a tire, to get a tire redone, and, you know, wasted an hour of her time waiting for the AAA and waiting for, because our donut tire was flat. She could have changed it. She's a tough Wyoming lady. I couldn't come help her change it because we share a vehicle, which is part of how we have money left over for emergencies, like changing a tire immediately, because I don't really have a lot of places I have to be. You know, occasionally I'll have a doctor's appointment, but I'll do it I can do my doctor's appointments at like 5:45 a.m. So I can go do them and then be back home with the car before she has to go for work. Works out well. You know, once a year, maybe she has to leave work and come pick me up and then take me somewhere. But I'm good. I'm self-sufficient. We're Wyoming folks. And, you know, we try to do the honorable thing, like the cowboy code, and let our neighbor know when there's a hole in his fence, as they say on ranches. Basically, let the bank know that there was a hazard that, you know, we weren't going to sue him, but somebody would. Somebody could easily trip on this, slash their leg open, need surgery, literally put an eye out, or just, you know, slash more tires with it. And the president of the bank called her up and was very standoffish and on the defense. And we weren't accusatory in our email, but he came back with right out of the gate with two things that are kind of bizarre. One is he said, this isn't our fault about the bank. And the other thing he said was, there's nothing we can do about this, which is kind of bizarre because my thought immediately when she told me about it was, you know, every construction site I've worked on, if you have something pointy that's uncovered, even overnight, even on a construction site that's not public property where people are, you know, going and coming 50 times a day, 100 times a day, more, you cap it. You know, they have these little orange safety caps, plastic in various sizes. I mean, part of my first job, other than like, you know, doing stuff for my parents for a quarter, 50 cents here and there for my dollar allowance a week in the 70s. You know, part of my first job really was construction work in 1980. And I wasn't doing construction. I was the helper. I swept up and I would, you know, walk. I would actually take my bicycle and ride up to the hardware store and get them things. And something I often was sent to get was various sizes of rebar covers. And they're just these little cheap caps. They're reusable. They're hard plastic, you know, not too hard. Like if you fall on them, it's not like a knife. It bends a little bit, but it's mainly, you know, it fits on there snug and it keeps, you know, so if some drunk person trespasses on your construction site in the middle of the night, goes in there to party and drink and, you know, trips over one of these rebars and loses an eye on the other rebar, they'll A, sue you, and B, just, you know, human suffering. You don't want that. You don't want that on your conscious, although it wouldn't really be on your conscious in that situation. I think it was on this guy's conscious, should have been on this guy's conscious in this situation, but he said that there was nothing they could do about it. And so this week, my wife drove up to the top of the hill to drop off the check at the same bank, and she approached really carefully driving, you know, parked away from it and got out and put the check in instead of driving up to it and risking this again. And she said they were covered with these little orange things. She never suggested that. That was just my first thought. And you know, this head of a bank who's so out of touch with reality that he's never been on a construction site believes nothing can be done about this. It was really disturbing to me. We weren't asking for anything. We were being good neighbors, basically. We were saying, hey, you got a problem, you should fix it. And he immediately went to the, you know, corporate banker speak of not our fault, nothing we can do, you know, legalese, basically. And it was kind of disparaging because it's a bank that has a real, projects itself as being neighborly and your friends and we're one of you. And it really didn't turn out that way. So that's the update on that. Kind of sad state of the world. Yeah. All right. What I've been up to. I've been kind of conspicuously absent for a while. And basically what I've been up to is relearning a new kind of music. I've been playing music for a long time. The first record I put out in 1984 when I was 20. And I've put out a bunch of records since then on, you know, put them out myself to, from putting them out ourselves to having, you know, to being signed to Warner Brothers for one of them and a bunch of them in between that on, you know, small, good indie labels. So with the records we'd put out ourselves, they were DIY, they were do-it-yourself, they were beyond do-it-yourself. I mean, it wasn't like these kids today where, you know, you get free software and buy a cheap mic and record in your bedroom and it might sound horrible or it might sound good. And then you put it up on Bandcamp or SoundCloud, one of these free websites, or YouTube. And you know, we had to suffer. We suffered for our art. And back in the day, the first record we put out was a band I was in called Baby Opaque. Baby Opaque. It's hard to find that music. If you can find it, if you have a record player, you can probably find the 7-inch or the 12-inch we did maybe on eBay. I don't know. I've seen it on eBay. Look for it. Look for it. It's not there. Don't look for it. It's not there. We'll tap there. The Electric Banana in Greenwich Village. Don't look for it. It's not there. No, so we put out this record and I paid for it partially with this construction job that I spoke of. And yes, I ended a sentence or part of a sentence there with a preposition. And there's really no reason not to do that. And anybody who says, never end a sentence with a preposition. Did I say proposition? A preposition. Don't proposition my preposition. So the thing about not ending a sentence with a preposition, there's no reason that should be a rule of English. Basically, it was a pet peeve of Noah Webster, who wrote the Webster's Dictionary and also wrote the first book on English rules, I guess, you know, a few hundred years ago. 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 150 years ago, something like that. Back when, you know, this steam engine would have been the pinnacle of technology. So yeah, he didn't like that. There's no reason to not end a sentence with a preposition. He just didn't like it. And so he put it in his rule book, and that rule book became the syllabus for teaching English, for teaching grammar, as they called it back in schools, back in the day, back before my dad, who's now 97 and still feisty, Before he was in a one-room schoolhouse and graduated at 15 in Sherman, New York, because he was pretty smart and he, you know, all the classes were in one big room and he mastered, you know, this stuff for seventh grade, and then he'd start listening in on the ninth grade class. And pretty soon he was, graduating high school at 15, got a job at 15 and a half, basically milk testing, what's called brick. I think it's brick, or is that with grapes? Anyway, testing the, is it the sugar or the acidity of, I don't know, something about milk, butterfat content. And the test for this involved sulfuric acid. And he told me that one time the thing like broke and he got sulfuric acid in his eyes and on his face. And he ran up to the farmhouse and asked the farm wife, said like was, couldn't see, and said, quick, give me some baking soda. And she did. She didn't ask any questions. Either she knew or that this would help, or she just, hey, when some young man screaming at your door who you've hired looks like he's heavily injured and his face is smoking and he's screaming, you probably do what he says within reason. And, he threw baking soda in his eyes, and then he said, take me to the kitchen. And he couldn't see, and she took him by the hand to the kitchen, and they had a pump, a water pump. And he said, please pump the water in the kitchen. They had an inside pump, and she started pumping it, and he started throwing water and more baking soda in his eyes and saved his eyes. People were a little tougher, and life was nasty, short, brutish, and cruel. One day at that job, okay, this is a trigger warning. This might disturb people. It's got gore, violence, but not violence of aggression, just something that happened. The violence of farming equipment and how nasty, short, brutish, and cruel life used to be. He showed up one day for one of those jobs, and there was no one at the farm. He'd been there before. He knew everybody, and there was just no one there. And he's like, what's going on? So he went down to the barn to see if they'd left samples for him on ice, and this is back when to get ice, you had to cut ice in the winter and save it in an ice house. And then a horse or possibly a car would bring it around and sell it to you during the summer. You know, sometimes they'd leave the milk in ice for him to test so they could take it to market and know the butterfat content of it. So he went into the barn. There's nobody in there. And he's kind of wondering what's going on. And he's testing milk, and he takes a little break and goes out to get some fresh air and walk around. And he sees a tractor that's still running. He didn't notice it when he drove up. It was kind of far away. And he walked down to the field where this tractor was still running, you know, just parked. And there was a thresher behind it, you know, something that chops grain or corn. I think corn for the cows. And there was a human arm, a severed human arm in the thresher. Some other teenager working had lost his arm in it, trying to reach in and repair it while somebody else was idling it and accidentally hit the gas or something, and or engaged the thresher, and it ripped the guy's arm off. And my dad saw this. And, you know, this is also like a testament to how bad, they'd rushed the guy to the hospital. They'd wrapped a belt, pulled off his belt, wrapped it around his arm as a tourniquet, and driven him 10 miles to the hospital in Westfield, the hospital where I was born. And they saved his life, but not his arm. And today, if you lost an arm, you might be able to save the arm. You know, if they bring the arm, drive real quick, call the hospital, tell them you're coming, have a team ready, you'd possibly save the arm in that situation. But nope, this was right after the Great Depression. He was alive during the Great Depression. So anyway, I get my do-it-yourself, pull yourself up by your bootstrap farmer attitude and drive from my dad. And thank him. I thank him for that. I thank Jack Dean for that. I applied that to the punk rock DIY ethic in the 80s and 90s. I was in this band called Baby Opaque. They were not a straight up punk rock band, but we played punk shows. Like my band Bomb Later, we were not a punk band, but we played punk shows. Also put out records with that band. Also put out records with a punk rock band called The Beef People, who were great and only around for a few months, but put out a record that people still speak of in whispered tones. And you can probably get The Beef People record on eBay. You can also get it on the Freedom Fiends blog site. Google Freedom Fiends blog, and then the words Beef People in quotes. If you don't put the other stuff, you won't find it, because Beef People is the motto of the Winn-Dixie chain. Is that still around? I don't know. That's an East Coast thing. I'm in Wyoming, so I don't know anymore. I don't even know anymore. Yeah, the Beef People were in Charlottesville, Virginia. Actually, Dyke, Virginia, D-Y-K-E, because the kids in the Beef People who were like 16 and 17, no, 17 and 18, and I was like 19 or 20. They were 17 or 18, and they went to an all-boys boarding school called the Blue Ridge School in Dyke, Virginia, about 40 miles outside, way out in the sticks. And their guitar player got kicked out for having a girl in his room. It was an all-boys boarding school. And I'd gone to an all-boys boarding school, too, and been kicked out for talking smack about the headmaster. That's a whole other episode. But they I was friends with the Beef People. They got their, you know, guitar player kicked out of school. And they called me up, you know, 20 years old, the elder statesman of punk rock to them. They were still late teens. And I joined the band, learned a bunch of their songs, played about nine gigs with them. Played nine gigs with them. Never played out of the state with them. And put out one record on Catch Trout Records, run by John Beers, who's another pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps kind of guy. And then broke up when they graduated. And then Brian Childers, the singer in that band, later we had him in our band Bomb, but he wasn't really on records, except he screams at the beginning of Happy All the Time, that song. Yeah. Oh, and I'm not using earphones today. I'm going raw. You know, baby, I like it raw. Baby, I like it raw. Baby, I like it raw. I can't sing. I could sing better if I could sing louder, but my wife's asleep, so I don't want to wake her up, because I'm a good man. Yep. I'm going raw dogging it, raw catting it here today on the radio. First time I think I've ever done an episode without headphones, but I think I've gotten to the point where I can just watch the meters, just watch the computer screen, and it's great, and I like it. And I busted out the good mic, the condenser mic. I usually use the dynamic mics for radio, because they're generally recommended for radio. They sound more like what people expect radio to be, but they also reject noise, like background noise, whereas a condenser mic is more for music. It picks up everything. But it's pretty quiet, so late at night, so maybe the Wyoming wind's getting picked up in the background, but I'm using the condenser mic and all a bunch of new equipment I got. I'm going to talk about that more, about how the free market of having bought some Bitcoin a few years ago, before it went up to 20,000, but, you know, when it was lower than it is now, what is it, 6,000, 7,000 now? I was in on the ground floor, and I recently cashed in a bunch of it, actually spent it on a site that you can spend it on, and bought a bunch of equipment, which I've always been like the guy who makes the best music with the least equipment, and I've written books on it, and it's kind of been my whole thing. But recently I just said, you know, I'm 54, I'm a man, I've got some money, I'm going to splurge. I'm not really splurge, like buy the tools of my trade and buy them right. And I still went, you know, low end, not low end, but researched, got the right things. My friend Jay helped me figure out what to get, because I haven't bought good equipment in a while, and things have changed a lot. So, I mean, back when I used to make records, we used to make them on tape. You had to pay someone to make them on tape for you, and it was expensive, so you really had to be ready to record. Now, these kids today, you can just, you know, you learn to play while recording, which, nothing wrong with it, really. But the reason, as I'm getting into this kind of music called microtonal music, and I'm kind of blowing people away with how good I am at it, like out the gate. Like, I've been doing it for about a month, and I've basically written and recorded with Phil for Biptunia, you know, with him doing vocal stuff, talking, basically. I've done about a record's worth. You know, I've written and recorded our next record in the past month of a whole new kind of music that some people study the mathematics of for years and then make stuff that's good or make stuff that's like not good. There's a lot of great stuff in microtonal, but there's a lot of like math geeks that aren't really musicians that get into it because they like the maths of it. That's the proper term, the mathematics of it. But but the fact that I could do music and have been doing it since before 1984, first record came out in 84, I actually started playing guitar when I was 14, which was 1978. And, you know, I've written a lot of songs, I've been on a lot of records, I've sang a lot, better than I sang a minute ago, because I could, you know, open my mouth wider and project. Yeah, But, you know, basically someone's going to do better in microtonal music if they know how to make music and then jump into microtonal music and don't really study the math than if they study the math extensively and they're good with math and don't really know music. And I'm also trying to do things to help people with microtonal music. Like, you know, I made a microtonal VST synth, which is, you know, some of the software you use to make this music. I mean, historically, it's been hard to make this music. Like, people had to suffer to make it. Like, for instance, I was talking about back in the day, when our first record came out, when Baby Opaque, which was not a microtonal band. But, you know, I was thinking the other day, like, a lot of stuff I used to do was kind of microtonal. Like, microtonal, okay, if you don't know, Western music, whether it's the Sex Pistols or Beethoven, Western music uses equal temperament, which is a 12-tone system. There's 12 semitones in an octave, 8 whole tones in an octave, and the notes are equal distant from each other. Now, there's something called just temperament, which was used before that, before in the 1600s, and that basically was like everything sounded perfectly in tune in one key, and you'd go to play in another key, and it would sound horribly out of tune. So just temperament, equal temperament was an attempt to improve just intonation by making it a little tiny bit out of tune in all 12 keys, or all 24 keys if you want to count major and minor. So, I mean, actually, there was a thing called, there was a series of writings called, was it something of 24 preludes and fugues by Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, called The Well-Tempered Clavier, which was basically beautiful musical propaganda for equal temperament. It was showing, you know, this can work. And he wrote this series of short pieces, one in each piece, to be played on the same harpsichord or clavichord or organ without retuning it. You know, it used to be if you're going to play in D minor, you had to retune for D minor. And back then, things were even harder than when I was making music in the 80s. I have a friend. My friend Jay has had a harpsichord, and he said he sold it because it was so hard to keep in tune that you'd basically tune it, you know, with a little, like, tuning hammer. It was kind of like changing the tension, the torque on a, I don't know, kind of like something you use in an engine. The things that you use in engines to adjust torque are probably based on the tuning hammers from piano, or from back in the day, from, you know, pre-piano keyboards. And you'd, you know, you'd listen and you'd tune and you'd tune and you'd tune and you'd tune the whole thing. And then you'd have to start over and tune it again, because tuning it would change the tension on one side of the soundboard to the other, from the treble to the bass, where you'd be a little out of tune on the bass side then and have to go back and tune it. And I think I've always been trying to do microtonal music, which is music that is any music that is not 12-tone equal temperament. And, you know, it's kind of like people think that, you know, industrial music or punk rock or whatever, you know, whatever the kids are doing today that's like shocking, and they take the drugs and go to the dances. Like, music always shocks people, you know, the latest generation. But, and that's been going back to, I mean, you know, Mozart, go watch the movie Amadeus. It's based on truth. Like, Mozart, which people think of like the pinnacle of like staid European, stately, beautiful, kind of old-fashioned music now. Like, Mozart was shocking in his day. He was the Sex Pistols of his day, and he kind of acted like it too. But the new music always shocks the youth. I remember thinking in like 19 when the Sex Pistols came out, like, originally I hated them because I liked Pink Floyd and Sid Vicious. Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols. There was a famous picture of him in a t-shirt. It was a Pink Floyd shirt, and under Pink Floyd he wrote "Sucks." And that was his statement to the world. And I was like, that's horrible. How could you not like this Pink Floyd? Those people are bad. And then I heard him and I liked him, and ended up playing in a hardcore band later, hardcore punk rock band, which is faster and louder and snottier than the Sex Pistols. The Sex Pistols sound almost slow and boring compared to hardcore punk rock. And I remember playing in punk bands in the early 80s and thinking, you know, I mean, it was shocking. Like, I used to get, we lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I used to get, you know, bottles thrown at me out of pickup trucks by people who were offended that we had shaved heads or mohawks or green hair and, you know, dressed kind of ratty. I mean, I dressed ratty because I was poor. I still dress kind of ratty. I've never given up my integrity of dressing like a bum. Basically, I was grunge before grunge. Like, there's a picture of me where I'm six or seven, standing on the shore of Lake Erie, smiling. And my mother took this picture. I have it somewhere. And it's like, I'm dressed like Kurt Cobain was dressed later, you know, decades later. I was always kind of grunge, and I'm still kind of grunge. It was in style for about 4 years in the early, late 80s, early 90s. But otherwise, I mean, completely out of style. So I remember playing in this punk rock band that, you know, rednecks would scream out of pickup trucks and throw bottles at my head and narrowly miss and yell, you know, F you, Devo, or Blondie sucks, you know, like bands that I weren't even what I was into. Well, I like those bands, but, you know, I'm people misunderstood. We suffered for our art is what I'm saying. People, you know, literally there was a threat of physical harm of playing weird music back then. And I remember during that time thinking like, you know, what's going to come along that shocks me? You know, what's the next? I felt unshockable. And I theorized in about 78, I think, 79. I was like, I think what it's going to be is music that's about the joys of murdering people. And I said that like half jokingly, half seriously. I'd never heard of such a thing. I mean, the closest thing I can think I've heard of is Johnny Cash probably has a couple songs about murdering people. Delia, Long Black Veil, which he didn't write, but he's known for doing. And actually, my band Baby Opaque covered that, kind of a punk rock version with Ian MacKay from Minor Threat, actually Fugazi at the time, singing backup. And yeah, but you know, like I said, there's going to be... I said there's going to be music with no melody that's about bragging about murder and how cool murder is. And it's going to be written by murderers. And I said that, and I was basically predating, you know, I mean, there was hip hop sort of when I was saying this, but all the hip hop back then was like party. Like, yeah, I'm at the, I can't rap, but it was like, you know, I'm at the club, I'm with the girlies, you know, hip hop, hippity hop, and you don't stop, you know. Mama said, knock you out, was like about as rough as it got back then. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I was that prescient to really predict that. I really think it was Johnny Cash. It's funny, too, because a lot of, you know, rural Americans, I live in rural America. I'm not putting us down, you know, but I've heard a lot of people like complain when rap music came out, like, this is horrible. It's all about drug use and easy sex and killing people. And I'm thinking like, I can name 10 country songs about each of those things. But yeah, so I always wondered what it would be. And now it's kind of like, to me, like the thing is, that I think is shocking to people is microtonal music, because it largely sounds out of tune to most people, especially people that won't give it a chance. I mean, it's kind of like if you speak English your whole life and then you hear another language spoken. Even if the person speaking the other language is speaking beautifully in a poetic way and is a great public speaker, like if it's a language you don't understand at all, it's going to sound like gibberish to you. And, you know, you might not hate it. You might just be like, I don't get it, which is how microtonal music is to a lot of people. So microtonal music, also known as Zen harmonic music, Zenharmonic, the more common term is microtonal, and they're kind of interchangeable. They're kind of not. I say microtonal because more people know what it means. But actually, microtonal technically means music where the intervals are smaller than in the 12-tone scale. Like, you know, instead of 12 tet, 12 tone equal temperament, also known as 12 EDO, 12 equal division of octave. You know, I mean, there's a punk rock band called... Jock Tears, which I think is the best band name I've ever heard. Jock Tears, everything they do is in 17 EDO. And like I said, to do this kind of music for a lot of people, it's you used to have to alter your instruments or make instruments. And there's a lot of people that make microtonal music on guitar. I mean, you can either play slide guitar, because then you can go between the notes of the 12 steps of the Western scale that all guitars are tuned to, or you can buy specially made guitars. And like Jock Tears, they have a special guitar and a special bass that they paid someone to make or refret. And it's weird. And some microtonal guitars, like the frets don't even go all the way across. They go halfway across, and then there's another one going halfway across or three quarters of the way across. It's pretty bizarre for different tunings. But you can only use that for that one tuning then. And also, like, if you're on tour and your guitar gets stolen or breaks, you know, unless you're playing with another band that uses that same tuning, you can borrow a guitar from really quick. Like, the show's over, or let's say you break all your strings on your guitar, playing a really furious solo in 17 EDO, you know, you'd have to stop the show, retune, you know, restring the guitar. And then when you restring a guitar, they're generally a little out of tune for about an hour. You can stretch them on the spot, but, you know, you'd... You wouldn't sound great at first. Generally, bands that can afford to, even like my band, when we were touring, brought two guitars. You know, the guitar player brought an ex. Well, we had two guitarists, and they brought a third guitar between them that one guitarist used on one song. But it was the guitar for if someone broke a string. You know, the roadie would hand them the other guitar. It would already be in tune. They'd change it really quickly, switch over to the other guitar. You know, do a sound check of da 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 to see if it's in tune, and then just play the next song. Like, there were not breaks. Breaks were insulting to the audience to me. And that's the thing that I always did with bands, was practice going bam, 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 one song right into the next. And that has kind of worked into my making records now that I don't tour with Biptunia, is my band, of making the records as a piece. You know, Phil and I write and record a bunch of songs somewhere between, we do long records, somewhere between, you know, 55 minutes and 93 minutes, I think, are our records. Our seven records? Yeah, seven records that we've done in a year. We're prolific. I sequence the albums when I'm done recording them and mastering them to go one song into the next. Sometimes they even overlap a little bit and fade out and then fade in over each other. But generally, it's more like there's, you know, a half second of silence between songs, if that. And I'm very conscientious about, I work hard at working on how the songs go one into the next. I try to do that with everything I do. I try to make everything the best it can be without a delay, the best it can be without taking forever to do it, the best it can be without spending a lot of money. You know, like I was saying about the punk rock DIY ethic, when my first record came out, Baby Opaque's 7-inch EP in Charlottesville, Virginia. And no, I did not go to college there. I was not a college student. I lived in a college town, but colleges. You know, when you say things like, ugh, colleges, people think you're anti-intelligence or anti-education. I'm not. I just think that a lot of colleges are conformity factories. And lately, the conformity is left-wing instead of right-wing, which is really bizarre to me, because when I was growing up, the squares were right-wing, and now the squares are left and right wing. But, you know, the really heinous, scariest ones to me, maybe, are left wing. It's tough. It's a toss up. But yeah, man. And Charlottesville is like ground zero for progressive thought. Like, the paper in Charlottesville is called the Daily Progress. And it was back in the 80s when I lived there. And I think it'd been called that for 50 years or something. Yeah, so we made the record. And we didn't have enough money to get covers made, to get record covers made. We had enough money to press the vinyl, you know, the 7-inch vinyl. We bought 1,000 of these records, and they came in paper sleeves, white paper sleeves with nothing on them. And I paid for part of this by my $4 an hour construction job. Like, that's one reason I've always kind of dressed like a bum, or at least not dressed like a bum, but not bought new clothes much. Like, I spend a lot more on microphones than I do on pants, for instance. You know, I'll buy a pair of pants and wear them for 4 years, you know, five pairs of pants and wear them for 4 years and then replace them as they wear out. I don't wear them with holes in them anymore, you know, gaping holes like I did back in the day. I'm not that poor, but, you know, I need to be able to buy equipment, because equipment drives what I do and everything I do. And a lot of what I do, I give away, you know, a lot of the music I do, I give away. I don't try to sell it. I mean, I sell it. It's for sale, but I give away a lot more of it than I sell. And I'm on a mission, so I don't have a problem doing that. And there's some people who are like, oh, you don't make money, it's your art. Well, then it's not worth having. Well, no, apparently it is worth having, because about 400 people a day, you know, 400 song downloads a day. You know, I don't want to bother selling it. It takes too much time, and people don't really buy it. They think music should be free now, and I'm fine with that. Because I just really want to touch people in special places with my music. My name, Michael Dean. An anagram for Michael Dean is Deal Machine. And, you know, I'm making a lot of deals all the time, but not all of them involve money, or at least not a lot of them involve money for me. Like right now, I'm putting together a microtonal benefit compilation album for Lynn Ulbrich, who's the mother of Ross Ulbrich, the Silk Road guy, the guy who's in prison in Colorado. for 2 life terms plus without parole for running a website. He's in the same prison. This guy made a website where people could buy and sell drugs. He didn't buy and sell drugs. He just made a website where they could do it. He made the free market. And if anybody thinks that's shocking and horrible, I mean, people listen to this on radio. You probably believe the government shouldn't be able to tell you what to do with your healthcare, right? Well, then why should they be able to tell you what to do with what you put in your body? You know, and really, like, for instance, okay, marijuana is far safer than alcohol. No one ever dies of marijuana overdoses. People die of alcohol overdoses every day. But marijuana is illegal. It's a felony in Wyoming. It's legal next door in Colorado, but it's a felony here. And, you know, if also the if you can't allow the thought of people